So we are now live. We're not live, that's not true, but we're recording.
Hello world.
Hello and welcome back to Sea Gazing, a podcast about conservation and community on the coast in Scotland. With me, Graham Richardson.
And me, Nicolette McLeod. And thanks so much for tuning in to episode 4. We hope you're enjoying it so far. We certainly are. Any good stories about the sea for us today, Graham?
That's almost like I didn't make you ask me that, Nico. I did just want to share, I was at the sea. I mean, it's a little while ago now because I can't move very much, but I did see a new bird. And for people that know me, I am a big bird geek, and I was very excited to see a new bird. It was a long-tailed duck, which the individual I saw didn't have a long tail because I think it was a female, but it was still pretty awesome. And I got very excited.
Oh, you should share a picture with us on...
I will. I didn't get a good one because it was very far away, okay. But it was just sitting there being a duck, swimming. Ducks are great. Birds are great.
Yes, I would agree with that. You're going to next week be talking to someone about birds. Is this true?
I know. I was going to say that too. So next week I get to talk. I'm not going to give away who it is yet, but I'm going to talk to someone about seabirds and birds in general on the coast. And I got very excited doing that, so little taster.
And today, Graham is talking to Catherine Gemmell, who works for the Marine Conservation Society Scotland, which is very exciting. I listened to it and really enjoyed it.
Yeah, and we do talk about a lot of things, but instead of telling you about that, I wanted to start with something a bit different today, because one of the topics we talk about and have talked about in past episodes are marine protected areas. And there are quite a number of types of marine protected areas. So I wanted to do a little introduction to what sort of things we're talking about when we talk about these areas in relation to the sea. So do you have any idea of how many different types of MPA we have in Scotland that relate to the sea or relate to nature in some way?
No, I actually have no idea, but I'm going to just go guess at 10.
So it's a little fewer than that.
Okay.
A good guess.
Six.
Six is a pretty good guess. So we've got five that are very specifically to do with nature or their habitats, and one which I think is often to do with it. But yeah, so we've got a couple that are came from the EU, which fingers crossed look like they're going to be kept once we leave the EU. And they're for specific-ish things, but they're not got very descriptive names, so I'm just going to refer to my notes. So we've got special protection areas, and we've got special areas of conservation. Okay, so those are the first two. Any idea what they might be for?
Okay, so special protected areas, I'm thinking something that is very special and needs protecting.
Ding, ding, ding. That's very true, because they are for very special things, because they're for birds.
And the second one I'm trying to remember.
Special areas of conservation.
It was another special. I was like, I think it's another special. Special areas of conservation. So my guess again would be that maybe it was to do with a place rather than a thing or a creature. Is that?
That's a pretty good guess. So yeah, they are more to do with habitat, but they can also be to do with particular species, but just not birds in this case.
Okay.
So I know this is confusing so far, but we've got special protection areas specifically for birds. And special areas of conservation for other things. Now, we've also got a couple of things you maybe have heard of. We've got sites of special scientific interest that are there to protect what we call part of our natural heritage. So that could refer to plants, could refer to animals, or special areas of geology. And they can often coincide with the two we've just talked about. Stay with me.
I'm with you. I just got excited when you said geology because I started thinking about rocks. I love rocks. Anyway,
exactly.
Carry on.
And we've also got Ramsar sites, and they are specifically focused on wetlands, and in this case, coastal wetlands specifically. So far, special protection areas, special areas of conservation, Ramsar sites, and triple SIs. Okay, that's a lot of stuff to remember. But then the kind of the newest type of marine protected areas are called marine protected areas, just to clear away all the confusion. And specifically, these are nature conservation MPAs. So, for example, when we talked about the South Arran MPA, that was a nature conservation marine protected area brought in by the Scottish government. So as with all of these things, this type of marine protected area is there to protect what they call features. And again, this could be a species or it could be a habitat. So for example, in South Arran, it was brought in to protect habitats like burrowed mud, but also species like merle and like seagrass. And when we talked with Danny last week, he said that every type of MPA has a different set of rules. And that's where a lot of the confusion comes in, because you wouldn't protect the things in the South Arran MPA in the same way as you'd protect species or habitats in a different MPA. Now, we can also ask the question, should we be only protecting one species or one habitat in an area instead of protecting the whole thing in a holistic way? And that is a debate for another time. Now, just to finish it off, we've got two more types of marine protected area, one of which is a demonstration and research marine protected area, which we will be talking about in a future episode, because we only have one of those in Scotland right now, and it can be to do with nature. And the last is a historic marine protected area, which is all to do with historical features. Now, in total, with all these put together into a network, we have 232 different marine protected areas in Scotland. Now, I know this is all really confusing, and I don't expect anyone to remember all of this. It is interesting to look into, but there's a lot of different pieces of legislation. But what I think is going to come out from the interviews we've done in the past, and the interview we're going to do today, is that it's not about how many areas we're protecting in Scotland or in the rest of the UK, it's how effectively we actually manage them. And that's a really big point of debate right now.
Yeah.
Nico, you're still awake, and I'm really impressed.
I'm still awake, and I'm, thinking about, legalities and how these are enforced and the importance of them not becoming paper parks, which is a term that I've heard used to describe some of them, which makes me feel sad and angry. So hopefully, if enough people kick up a stink, we can get some changes made. And those changes need to come from government. Catherine's awesome. I've listened to this interview and I'm excited for you all to hear it.
Yeah. We should just say this was the very first interview we did. So primarily, thank you, Catherine, for putting her trust into us. I hope it's merited. That also does mean we had a few issues with sound quality. But I like to think that when that happens, it actually sounds like we're under the sea during the interview. So if you can just roll with that, with your imagination, that would be perfect. But it was too good to not have. Catherine's really great and a really amazing speaker. And you should definitely look up her other videos after this.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. She's got some great content online, so do check her out.
Great. Shall we have a listen?
Yeah.
Catherine, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast. It is really great to have you here. We're going to talk about a lot of different things today. I want to talk to you about the people that you work with especially, but we like to start the podcast by getting a picture of the sea. So when you close your eyes and when you think of the sea, the coast, or the ocean, what is that image that comes up in your mind?
So for me, it's probably my home beach. So it's Fintorn Beach up in Moray. So it's a beautiful pebbly shore. And you always get to kind of run down the wooden steps from the dunes. You hit the pebbles and then you kind of skate surf down the pebbles to reach the sand to see the breakers coming through. And for me, it's always to look straight out onto the horizon first to see if I can spot any of the residential dolphins that I used to watch growing up along there. So for me, that's always the first place my mind goes to.
It must be an incredible experience to see dolphins as a kid.
It was. It's just always so exciting. Although I think dolphin spotting anywhere in the world, especially in Scotland, where we usually have quite choppy waves most of the time, it's amazing how excited you get about a certain wave breaking, thinking it's a fin, and then you realise, nope, that was just another wave.
Absolutely. So is there something special about Scotland sees to you now, that you, especially because you work with them every day?
I think for me, what I've loved about this job, and obviously growing up in Scotland and living in a few different places, is the diversity of Scotland's coastlines. We literally, I personally think we have it all. everything from, you know, the amazing wildlife to the sandy stretches of beach out in the Outer Hebrides. My family actually lives out on the Isle of Barra. So some of the beaches out there, the pictures I look back on, they look like something out of the Caribbean with the white sand and the turquoise waters. You just see us all in bobble hats and realise maybe the temperature's not quite Caribbean. But then we've got the amazing sea cliffs full of seabirds and the rocky shores for wildlife in our rock pools. So I think for me, Scotland's coastlines are just spectacular because they're just so different.
I was by the beach for the first time myself the other day, and the first time rock pooling. I didn't find anything particularly exciting this time, but I did wonder then, what's the most exciting thing you have found in a rock pool?
Oh my goodness, that's an excellent question. So I think the most exciting thing I've ever found in a rock pool is a nudibranch, so a sea slug. And I was actually doing field work when I was at university in Aberdeen, and we were doing some coursework. So me and a friend went out to Cummingston Beach up in the northeast along the Murray coast, and we found these kind of beautiful, these were really little nudibranchs, and they were like bright white and yellow, but my friend had never seen them before and didn't even know sea slugs existed. So that's probably one of the most exciting things. But I have to admit, I'm a huge hermit crab fan. Every time I see a hermit crab, I get very excited.
So are nudibranchs, because whenever I look at nudibranchs, pictures of them, they're one of those animals that look tropical, and I've never really thought about them being in Scotland, but are they pretty widespread?
Yeah, we get so many species around Scotland. There's kind of a sect of divers that are very much into nudibranchs. It's a very niche kind of wildlife. But the fact that you can see them when you're snorkeling or even find them in rock pools is really exciting. You just have to be quite patient because a lot of them are absolutely tiny. I think some of them can be like the size of my fingernail kind of thing. And it is just about being really careful and just sitting and watching, and you will then maybe start to see them just slowly coming out. But others will kind of more be the size of your hand. They can be quite big. I think our sea hares are the other thing that a lot of people can see. So it's really interesting to actually open people's eyes to the weird and wonderful creatures that we have in Scotland that, as you say, you might expect to see on a tropical coral reef somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. And I know that one of the best ways to connect with and see these animals is to go diving underwater. And that's a world that I've just gotten into and is really worthwhile once I get over the panic of being 18 metres underwater. But I know you yourself are a keen diver. So how long have you been diving for, and what is it that gets you excited about being underwater?
So I learnt to dive at uni. So gosh, when did I go to university? That would have been back in 2008. I started at Aberdeen Uni and joined the BZAC, the British Tobacco Club, student club there. So learnt to dive off the coast of Aberdeen in, I think my first dive was in February. So you can imagine the joy that that was. But I think it was amazing for me, even though my first dive, the visibility was terrible. I couldn't see my instructor, even though they were less than a meter away from me. And I got super excited because I saw seaweed underwater. My instructor was like, yeah, you're going to stick at this. If you got excited about that, just you wait till the visibility is good and we're seeing some amazing creatures or underwater wrecks. But it's one of the quite funny but sad things. Since I started working for MCS 5 years ago, I think I've only been diving a handful of times. So it's funny, isn't it, how a hobby that you've had as a student and through other jobs, I finally get into a job that is all about marine conservation, and I suddenly find I don't have the time to dive, which I'm hoping to change soon. But snorkeling is what I've fallen back on because my partner doesn't dive. So I'm kind of starting to introduce him slowly into Scottish seas through the realm of snorkeling.
I've been wondering if snorkeling is my way back into not feeling anxious about diving. And I've only, again, you think it's a tropical thing in warm waters, but obviously you can go snorkeling anywhere in the same place. You just might be freezing.
Exactly.
But so you mentioned your job, something I want to talk about now, that you work for the Marine Conservation Society, which is a large UK charity, and you work as Scottish Conservation Officer, and we've had some conversations about what that means, and I'm still not sure I can entirely pin it down. So what is your role? What is it that you do with the society?
It's a really good question. And to be honest, for me, it almost changes daily as well, as you can imagine. So as you said, MCS, we are a UK charity, but a lot of the environmental legislation is devolved to the Scottish Government. So when we had our devolved parliament, the MCS recognised that we needed a specific Scottish programme. So my manager, Callum Duncan, set it up back in 2000. So we're actually celebrating our 20th birthday of MCS in Scotland this year, which is amazing. And over the years, the programme has just grown and grown. We've obviously got so much spectacular coastline and sea in Scotland, and we need to be working with the Scottish Government, the Parliament, businesses and people to make sure that it's recognised, celebrated and protected. So I joined about 5 years ago to basically kind of help Callum out. Across the charity, we've got three main work areas, including ocean recovery, which is around our marine protected areas and protecting specific species or habitats. We've got sustainable seafood, which is all about trying to ensure those of us who eat seafood choose sustainable options, and working with industry and government to ensure that our whole seafood industry is more sustainable. And then the last work area is around clean seas and beaches. And this is where my role fits most. So what I try and do in Scotland is trying to deliver all the campaign work, all the projects we do around keeping our beaches and our seas clean. So what kind of coincided with me starting was this huge wave of awareness around marine litter and especially plastics. So I think I could probably describe my job in a nutshell is doing everything from working with volunteers and citizen science to find out what plastic and what litter is turning up on Scotland's beaches, and then using that information to work with policymakers, whether that be Parliament, whether that be government or business, to try and introduce new policy, new changes to stop that litter getting onto our beaches in the first place.
I do want to pick up on the like the clean beaches and the rubbish, literally the rubbish problem in Scotland's seas. It does feel like we all became aware of plastic problem because of something like Blue Planet, and because of the video of someone pulling a straw out of a turtle's nose. Like, is it something that's been around for a lot longer than that we've known about and haven't done anything about? Or did the scientific community kind of only realise that it was such a problem at the same time?
I think, sadly, as with a lot of the kind of crises that we're facing in nature today, we have known about for a long time. And at MCS, you know, this obviously goes back way beyond I started, or even Callum starting back in 2000, because our Beach Watch project, which is the citizen science project all about the beach cleaning and the collecting litter, is celebrating its 27th anniversary this year. So the fact that 27 years ago, MCS recognised that litter on beaches were a problem and we needed to start recording it as evidence just gives you an idea about how long this problem has been known about and we've been trying to do something. But as you say, seeing it go mainstream by the BBC on Blue Planet 2, Sky News running their Sky Ocean Rescue campaign, it's just given it a whole new audience and a whole kind of momentum boost that's been needed.
For sure. And the public is very aware of the plastic crisis, of the need to clean up our beaches and our seas. And we're also very aware that climate change, the climate crisis is affecting our oceans and also the way we manage fisheries. So where are we? What is the state of Scotland's seas? What are the things we're doing better now? And what are the biggest problems?
So that, as you can imagine, is a very big question. Yeah. And I'm sure there would be many of my colleagues who'd be happy to talk about this over a drink for hours. For me personally, from the experiences I've had, if I was to say what the biggest problem is, not just in Scotland, but across the world, is inaction. It's the fact that there has been a lot of talk, there has been a lot of awareness raising, which is brilliant, but we need action and we need ambitious action yesterday. So from the kind of clean seas aspect, from the work on plastics and litter, we've had some great success stories over the past few years from the Scottish Government, such as the 5p carrier bag charge, the commitment to a deposit return system for bottles and cans, and banning cotton bud stems, which is all great, but things are moving so fast. We're putting so much into the ocean. We're using up so many resources that we need our governments, we need our businesses and big industry to really be looking at mass changes if we're going to actually get ourselves out of the climate crisis, the biodiversity crisis, the ocean crisis. So for me, it is a lack of action that's the biggest problem. And then specifically from the different work areas that we're doing, I don't think we can afford to actually only work on one, which I think is why it's great that MCS obviously has this kind of broad range of topics, because we need marine protected areas. We need them to be well managed. We need to be working with fisheries and aquaculture to make sure that they're sustainable for the wildlife and for the sea. But we're also looking at things like food security for where people's food and their proteins coming from, as well as the big marine litter problem and linking it back to how can we be getting big changes, like looking at our whole economy rather than just specific bans or specific charges for items.
It does seem that one of the biggest issues with conservation is that we manage certain areas or certain species without thinking of the connectedness between them and how they all affect each other. So how important is it to have all these types of work together in one organisation?
I think it is so important, and it was lovely for you saying that we're a very large charity, but in this kind of field, especially in Scotland, we're actually very small. For me and Callum, we do make up the entirety of the Scotland team. So thinking about networking actually across organisations and businesses and government is essential for us to get this conservation work done. So for a lot of the ocean recovery work that we do it through the umbrella organisation called Scottish Environment Link, which brings together hundreds of organisations across Scotland to work together. So we're pooling knowledge and we're pooling resources to get the right messages across. Because if we're not kind of networked and working together across environmental organisations, our poor ocean doesn't really stand a chance, because you're exactly right. The only way our marine protected areas are going to work is if they're part of a well-managed and well-thought-out network. They're not going to work just on their own. They've got to be part of one big picture.
Absolutely. So you've been talking a lot about activism and taking action already, and I think that's what I really want to talk to you about today. It's great to hear that you are working with so many different organizations. And on the podcast, we're planning to talk to a lot of the smaller organizations, of the individuals that are doing work, maybe in one specific physical location or potentially on one specific species. So what are the differences between working on a slightly larger scale and working on a smaller scale with local groups? And how do you work together?
It's a brilliant question, and I think that's what's something that's always drawn me to my role at MCS and all the campaigns that we run, is everything we do usually has kind of three clear levels of engagement. So we aim to engage government at the top to get kind of the high level policy changes and law changes that we want. We aim to work with business and industry, so whether that's trying to get supermarkets to pledge to use less single-use plastics, whether it's getting washing machine manufacturers to implement microfiber filters. And then we always work with the individual about behaviour change and awareness raising as well, which is why we've got such a brilliant project called the Sea Champion Volunteering Project. So it is all about working with individuals or community groups to help give them the resources, the knowledge and the support that they need to do some of the brilliant grassroots campaigning that we've seen across Scotland. And I think this is where it is really important, and you always tend to fall back on cliches, but it is because they're true, is that an individual can make a huge difference. Because for those of us who maybe mostly work across a national level, to have volunteers on the ground doing brilliant work in their local area, but also being an eye on what's happening, whether it's a business maybe not quite doing the right thing, maybe it's wildlife that's turning up that hasn't been there before, having these people recording and reporting what they're seeing and what's happening then makes us aware of what's happening, so we can then help from a national level. So I think in a nutshell, I can't actually express how important having individual and community groups involved in conservation is.
And how easy is it for people to stay connected with the citizen science work they do? Is it easy for you to show them how their actions are directly affecting policy, or is there some sort of a gap between that work and a policy shift?
I think there sometimes can be quite a big gap, and I think that's what I've really enjoyed, trying to improve that connectivity between somebody picking up a crisp packet on a beach and recording it on our survey form to then me speaking to government and getting that policy change. And I think over the years, the Beachwatch project has been better at communicating back to our volunteers. I think with the kind of digital revolution of communication with social media and emails, you know, we're so far away from when we could only get in contact with our volunteers by a letter or by telephone. So trying to get that feedback back to them to say, the 5p carrier bag charge is thanks to you. If you didn't record all those bags, we wouldn't have had the evidence to get that law passed. So I think we've got better at it, but I think the tools that we now have to be able to connect volunteers to the success stories has just been so useful, because it's so nice now for me, just on my personal Twitter account even, to engage with volunteers and point them towards the things that I've done that I've only been able to do thanks to the data that they've recorded, or thanks to maybe a meeting they've had with a local councillor or with a local MSP. So I think there's still some way to go, because as we discussed at the beginning, Scotland's coastline is so spectacular diverse that it does mean it is more challenging for individuals or communities in different places to do citizen science. So for example, with Beachwatch, it's very easy, obviously pre-restrictions, to organise a big community cleanup across the Central Belt, because there's lots of people, there's really easy access to the coast, and the councils have a lot of resources to help remove the rubbish. But we've got loads of volunteers who are working and living in very rural, remote areas where the amount of litter is just so huge, they're not able to count it and collect it themselves, or the local authority doesn't have the resources to collect it either. So I think there are still quite a lot of barriers for people to take part in citizen science, and it might depend on where they live and the resources that's available to them.
For sure. And I imagine, I could be wrong, but I imagine it's easier to motivate people that live by the coast to do projects, to, especially if they can physically see rubbish on the beaches. But how do you motivate people that live in cities or live far away from the coast to be active as well?
Yes, it's something that's actually, during lockdown, we've really had to think about, because nobody, unless you literally lived on the beach pretty much, weren't being able to travel to the coast. So we kind of started thinking about, how do we bring the ocean indoors? So no matter where you live, you can feel connected to the ocean. So that's all about, a bit like what we did at the start. It's literally just thinking about your favourite memories and how you value the sea, whether it's distant holiday memories or a favourite sea creature or a film or documentary you've seen about it. But it's then also thinking about how physically you or your place where you live is connected to the sea, and starting to take people on that journey about how our rivers and our waterways and our drains and everything we do every day does impact the ocean. I think we've still got a long way on helping people take that journey and understand the impact that they might have in their local park or their street can actually affect the ocean as well. But I think this idea of source to sea is starting to grow. We've seen it across a lot of organisations as well. And I think it's going to always be a challenge, and it might not necessarily be a geographical challenge, but it might just be that some people just don't have the capacity to be able to prioritise the ocean at the moment. So it's, how do we actually open up the ocean to everybody, no matter where you are and what your priorities are at the time?
Absolutely. And do you find there's any difference between engaging people first and keeping people engaged? Because I imagine after a while we hear the word plastic in our oceans, and at first we think that's incredible, but after a year or two, it's kind of old news, even though the problem hasn't moved on. Do you come across that fatigue?
It's something I get asked a lot, actually, is how can I keep going out to do beach cleans when literally every tide just brings in more? And the thing that does keep inspiring me is that there is always another volunteer. There's always another group who are just carrying on. They're just battling it. We've got some volunteers who've been doing this since the beginning. They've been beach cleaning for 27 years. So for me, it's always like, if they're still doing it, if they're still finding the motivation to go out and know that it's making a difference, I can do it too. And I think what's important to remember is we obviously focus a lot on the citizen science and the recording of the data, which is so important. But it's also just remembering that every single piece of litter that you're removing from the beach is one less item of litter that could impact a marine animal, whether or not they accidentally eat it or get tangled up in it as well. So sometimes it's important to actually bring it all the way back down to just your local individual action and knowing that you have made a difference. You might not have changed the law today, but you may have saved a turtle's life, which is actually really important to remember.
Yeah, that's quite powerful. I've never quite pictured it like that. So I want to move on sort of from the individual actions to changing policies and changing business policies, because some of the work we do is individual action, but we know that ultimately a lot of the goals of the things we do is to change policy higher up with people who can, you know, make whole scale changes. So what is it like working with businesses and governments? Is there something different about that relationship, or do you find it similar to working with community groups?
It can actually be really similar in that it is just true, everybody's different. And it's also just remembering that behind government, behind parliament, and behind industry, it's still people and individual people, and they will respond to different techniques and different pieces of evidence and just different ways of engaging them. I think the difference is with a lot of our volunteers, they are willing, they want to be engaged and they want to do something. The challenge sometimes with maybe people from a business that we're trying to engage or from a particular member of parliament or minister in government is it just might not be something that interests them or might be not something that is on their either their business plan priority or a government priority. So that's probably the biggest difference there is how do you then get them to the stage where they're willing to engage and to listen to you. Because a lot of the time, your volunteers and members of the public, they're coming to you asking to be engaged.
And have you found a magic formula?
I think for me, for working around marine litter, the magic formula is where possible to try and get them to a local beach, to do a beach clean with some of the local volunteers. So for businesses, that's their customers. For ministers or for MSPs, that's their constituents, that's their voting community. So that's usually a really good kind of engagement offering to get them there. And then the amount of time you then run the beach clean with them and they kind of stop and they're like, I know you've sent us all the reports. I know you've sent us the figures, but I didn't know this was such a problem in my beach, or I didn't know what it actually looked like. And I think that's the same for all of us. You've probably read so many scientific papers or seen so many stats and facts. But I think for a lot of us, it doesn't really hit home until you're actually there in the middle of it. And especially if you can bring it back down to a local perspective, you know, this is where people live and this is where people work. With the plastics, I think a lot of people took a long time to realize it was impacting Scotland in such a big way because they'd seen the kind of pictures of the big gyres, of the big floating ocean plastic and kind of whirlpools, or some of the pictures from like Henderson Island, where it's these uninhabited islands that have got these piles of plastic. But when we're starting to take people out to Scottish beaches where we're seeing these huge volumes of plastic, or maybe it's a specific item. You know, I remember taking an MSP down to Crammond Beach in Edinburgh, and we picked up nearly 2,000 wet wipes in a 100-metre stretch. And they just didn't realise that this could still be a problem in this day and age. So I think it's probably not quite a magic formula, but it's definitely very powerful if you can engage these people by actually inviting them down to meet their local customers or their local constituents and actually take part in a beach clean. It does seem to put everybody on a level playing field and then really start to think about how to tackle the problem.
That's great. It's kind of like a reverse version of the NIMBY effect, not in my backyard. My experience with that was people that wanted clean energy but didn't want windmills in their backyard, so I'd say no, not in my backyard. But then you're taking someone to show them that actually the problem is in their backyard, it's here already and they need to do something to clean it up.
Exactly. And I think that's where it kind of brings everybody together. When we were talking about the importance of grassroots and individual action, what's so powerful and amazing for me is when you run one of these events and you see one of the local volunteers who started up the cleaning up program in their community directly engaging with the minister or with the MSP or a chief executive of a business. And that, I think, is when you know that conservation objectives will start being met, because they're actually doing them without you having to be directly involved. You've set it up, you've facilitated it, but you know that that minister or that chief exec or that MSP is going to probably listen more to that local volunteer than they would to you trying to feed them a report or to ask them to do something. And I think that's what's really amazing, when our volunteers realize that they have a complete right and they are able to contact these people who have the power to make changes and to ask the changes of them.
And I know that another tool you use to get the message out is by using the artistic community. And this is something quite close to my heart, because I've been a performer in the past, and it's sometimes hard to feel like your voice is actually making any change beyond the theatre or the art gallery. And we've talked about an artist you work with who makes plastic from makes installations from plastic found on beaches and connects with the community, and also a beautiful violin made from a piece of driftwood found on the beach. So could you tell me, in your experience and just in general, what is the role that people in creative industries can play?
I think it comes down to being able to work with people who are natural storytellers. Because again, that example of taking an MSP down to a beach, it's a form of storytelling in a different way. You know, they've said they get so many reports to read, they get so many people trying to have meetings with them. So actually the power of storytelling to open up somebody to a new subject area or to a new issue, I think the creative industry is just so good at it. And it's been one of my favorite parts of the job, is working with different creatives. So Julia Barnton, the litter artist, it was thanks to working with her for over a number of years that we were actually able to hold a parliamentary event in Holyrood. So MCS had never hosted a parliamentary event on their own. It's always been with other organisations. But Julia had been working on this amazing kind of literal art project and trying to engage people in the litter that was turning up on their beaches and thinking about where it came from. So linking it back to oil production and the fact that that's obviously a non-renewable source of energy. And doing it through projecting amazing things onto the roof, and also by making these cubes out of litter for people to weigh. So it's very interactive art as well. And it was thanks to her engaging with an MSP that she managed to get an event, and she invited us to co-host it to bring the science and the citizen science and the conservation objectives together. So I think that's been an absolutely fantastic partnership, and I can't wait to kind of see what Julia does next and how we can work together. So I think that's probably one of my favorite visual partnerships. And then from the musical side of things, the violin, the Ilmare violin, which was created by Steve Burnett and has been played by Thorin Forgeson at a lot of our events, has just been absolutely incredible. And it was created by Steve to literally be a voice of and for the sea. And I think it does capture the public's imagination. So I think working with these storytellers and these creatives allow us a whole new audience to talk about marine conservation. After all of that, we then actually got invited to help kind of put together a bit of a program for the International Marine Conference that the Scottish Government held to look at marine litter. So the Ilmari violin was then played at that conference as well. And although maybe not creative through the arts, but another kind of interesting partnership that has again led us to a new audience is with the Glenmorangie Whiskey Company as well. So it's actually making connections to, you know, whiskey being such an important part of Scotland's heritage and culture, and connecting that back to marine conservation as well. So I think for me, it was having a dram, listening to the Ilmari violin while the First Minister was hosting an international marine conference. It was brilliant to see all these kind of maybe unusual suspects coming together for one cause.
It is remarkable how, just like in conservation, when all the conservation efforts need to be connected, all these different groups of people can come together and connect in the same way. It's a very cheesy thing to say, but it's very true, the importance of connecting to something and connecting to it with other people.
No, exactly. And that's kind of one of the main principles of ocean literacy, isn't it? If we only actually have one ocean, it is all connected. And I think that's why ultimately, if we're not all working together to save it, to protect it, to celebrate it, we're not going to be able to do the job properly.
It's a proper call to action right there. So we're coming close to the end of the interview, but one of the things I wanted to finish with and I wanted you to talk about is this idea of ocean optimism, because I know it's something that you hold quite dear. I've heard you use that phrase quite a lot. So can you explain what ocean optimism is and why it's important?
It's actually a phrase that I came across a couple of years ago. I think I'd started to see it being used on social media, and I think I was just really drawn to it personally, as I am quite a positive person. I'm quite smiley and quite bubbly. I very rarely get very angry at anybody. So I had seen that obviously there's so many different ways to communicate conservation and what needs to be done. And I think I was trying to find my voice, like how do I make a difference, just me with my voice. And when I came across this ocean optimism phrase, I was like, that's it, that's me. And for me, it's kind of a few different elements to becoming an ocean optimist or promoting the idea of ocean optimism. And I think we've almost touched on a lot of them throughout the podcast. So the first one is literally just the joy that you feel by being connected to the ocean. And then it's also about taking positive steps to celebrate it, to protect it, to recover it as well. And for me, it is always drawing on the positive success stories. So it's seeing the volunteers doing amazing work. It's seeing the changes that we are making at government level, at industry level as well. So it's holding on to all of those positive things that are happening to keep my ocean optimism alive, and then also to try and inspire others to see it as well. It's really hard just now, you know. The fact that even before coming into 2020 and the extremely challenging year it's been so far, we were already facing a climate emergency. It's really difficult for a lot of people to think about how to deal with that and what difference can I make. So it is trying to step back. And for me, the ocean optimism is always just reminding myself, why am I doing what I do? And ultimately, I'm doing it because I love the sea and I want the sea to be there for me to continue loving it for a long time to come.
You might need to use your ocean optimism for this last question. Hopefully not too much. But where do you think Scotland's seas are going to be in 10 years?
So as an ocean optimist, I am going to say that the Scottish Government is going to be listening to all of us who are calling on a green recovery for Scotland coming out of the COVID-19 pandemic. And if they're putting in the big systemic changes that we're asking for investment in green and blue infrastructure and jobs. We're asking for a circular economy. We're asking for well-managed seas and fisheries and aquaculture. The ocean optimist in me tells me they're going to do all these things, which means in 10 years, we'll actually have really healthy seas that both wildlife and people can be enjoy and that Scotland can be proud of.
And that's, I think, a really perfect place to finish. Just before we go, is there any campaign or person or cause you particularly like to highlight for the people at home? Something they can do while we're still sort of in lockdown?
So there's so many things that people can still be doing, even if you're not able to visit the beach and you're still at home. And for me, I think it is becoming an ocean optimist and it's telling your story, no matter what your story is. So whether or not you're trying to reduce single-use plastic, tell the world about it as well, because that then inspires other people. And it also holds maybe businesses and governments to account about where they're failing you. Or maybe it's following a new wildlife photographer so you can continue to be inspired by the amazing animals that are visiting Scotland's shores. I think for me, become a storyteller for the sea would just be such a powerful thing and connect with as many different people as possible to make your stories as rich and as diverse as possible.
Great. Well, thank you very much for coming on and telling your own story today.
Thank you so much for having me, and hopefully we'll all be able to do a recording from the beach soon.
Oh, so that was such a lovely episode there, and really like the fact that Catherine sort of ended talking about ocean optimism, because I think that's something that's really important. And though we are touching on some serious topics in these episodes, I think it's really important that actually we're also hoping that it does also encourage and inspire people to know that there's really good stuff happening. There's awesome people out there who are fronting lots of these projects, and also there's stuff that we can do at home if we want to. So I think just for me, that's something to remember. It's my takeaway.
Yep, I completely agree. Ocean optimism is a really important thing for us all to have. So thank you so much for listening to the Seagazing podcast, and thank you so much to Catherine for taking the time to join us today.
And if you want to find out more about MCS, there are links on our website at seagazing.com.
We also do really want to know what you think, so please do send us feedback or send us ideas for news stories. You can get us either at Nicolette@seagazing.com or Graham@seagazing.com.
You can also find us on Twitter at seagazingpod. And remember, if you hit that subscribe button, it helps other people find us, and it also lets you know when we've got new episodes coming out. And if you give us a rate, ideally 5 stars, it will help other people find us.
Although, if the rating system is out of 10 stars, 10 would be great too.
Yeah, good point.
So, thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Litter that was turning up on their beaches, and thinking about where it came from, so linking it back to oil production and the fact that that's obviously a non-renewable source of energy, and doing it through projecting amazing things onto the roof, and also by making these cubes out of litter for people to weigh. So it's very interactive art as well. And it was thanks to her engaging with an MSP that she managed to get an event, and she invited us to co-host it to bring the science and the citizen science and the conservation objectives together. So I think that's been an absolutely fantastic partnership, and I can't wait to kind of see what Julia does next and how we can work together. So I think that's probably one of my favorite visual partnerships. And then from the musical side of things, the violin, the Ilmare violin, which was created by Steve Burnett and has been played by Thorin Forgeson at a lot of our events, has just been absolutely incredible. And it was created by Steve to literally be a voice of and for the sea. And I think it does capture the public's imagination. So I think working with these storytellers and these creatives allow us a whole new audience to talk about marine conservation. After all of that, we then actually got invited to help kind of put together a bit of a program for the International Marine Conference that the Scottish Government held to look at marine litter. So the Ilmari violin was then played at that conference as well. And although maybe not creative through the arts, but another kind of interesting partnership that has again led us to a new audience is with the Glenmorangie Whiskey Company as well. So it's actually making connections to, you know, whiskey being such an important part of Scotland's heritage and culture, and connecting that back to marine conservation as well. So I think for me, it was having a dram, listening to the Ilmari violin while the First Minister was hosting an international marine conference. It was brilliant to see all these kind of maybe unusual suspects coming together for one cause.
It is remarkable how, just like in conservation, when all the conservation efforts need to be connected, all these different groups of people can come together and connect in the same way. It's a very cheesy thing to say, but it's very true, the importance of connecting to something and connecting to it with other people.
No, exactly. And that's kind of one of the main principles of ocean literacy, isn't it? If we only actually have one ocean, it is all connected. And I think that's why ultimately, if we're not all working together to save it, to protect it, to celebrate it, we're not going to be able to do the job properly.
It's a proper call to action right there. So we're coming close to the end of the interview, but one of the things I wanted to finish with and I wanted you to talk about is this idea of ocean optimism, because I know it's something that you hold quite dear. I've heard you use that phrase quite a lot. So can you explain what ocean optimism is and why it's important?
It's actually a phrase that I came across a couple of years ago. I think I'd started to see it being used on social media, and I think I was just really drawn to it personally, as I am quite a positive person. I'm quite smiley and quite bubbly. I very rarely get very angry at anybody. So I had seen that obviously there's so many different ways to communicate conservation and what needs to be done. And I think I was trying to find my voice, like how do I make a difference, just me with my voice. And when I came across this ocean optimism phrase, I was like, that's it, that's me. And for me, it's kind of a few different elements to becoming an ocean optimist or promoting the idea of ocean optimism. And I think we've almost touched on a lot of them throughout the podcast. So the first one is literally just the joy that you feel by being connected to the ocean. And then it's also about taking positive steps to celebrate it, to protect it, to recover it as well. And for me, it is always drawing on the positive success stories. So it's seeing the volunteers doing amazing work. It's seeing the changes that we are making at government level, at industry level as well. So it's holding on to all of those positive things that are happening to keep my ocean optimism alive, and then also to try and inspire others to see it as well. It's really hard just now, you know. The fact that even before coming into 2020 and the extremely challenging year it's been so far, we were already facing a climate emergency. It's really difficult for a lot of people to think about how to deal with that and what difference can I make. So it is trying to step back. And for me, the ocean optimism is always just reminding myself, why am I doing what I do? And ultimately, I'm doing it because I love the sea and I want the sea to be there for me to continue loving it for a long time to come.
You might need to use your ocean optimism for this last question. Hopefully not too much. But where do you think Scotland's seas are going to be in 10 years?
So as an ocean optimist, I am going to say that the Scottish Government is going to be listening to all of us who are calling on a green recovery for Scotland coming out of the COVID-19 pandemic. And if they're putting in the big systemic changes that we're asking for investment in green and blue infrastructure and jobs. We're asking for a circular economy. We're asking for well-managed seas and fisheries and aquaculture. The ocean optimist in me tells me they're going to do all these things, which means in 10 years, we'll actually have really healthy seas that both wildlife and people can enjoy and that Scotland can be proud of.
And that's, I think, a really perfect place to finish. Just before we go, is there any campaign or person or cause you particularly like to highlight for the people at home, something they can do while we're still sort of in lockdown?
So there's so many things that people can still be doing, even if you're not able to visit the beach and you're still at home. And for me, I think it is becoming an ocean optimist and it's telling your story, no matter what your story is. So whether or not you're trying to reduce single-use plastic, tell the world about it as well, because that then inspires other people. And it also holds maybe businesses and governments to account about where they're failing you. Or maybe it's following a new wildlife photographer so you can continue to be inspired by the amazing animals that are visiting Scotland's shores. I think for me, become a storyteller for the sea would just be such a powerful thing, and connect with as many different people as possible to make your stories as rich and as diverse as possible.
Great. Well, thank you very much for coming on and telling your own story today.
Thank you so much for having me, and hopefully we'll all be able to do a recording from the beach soon.
Oh, so that was such a lovely episode there, and really like the fact that Catherine sort of ended talking about ocean optimism, because I think that's something that's really important. And though we are touching on some serious topics in these episodes, I think it's really important that actually we're also hoping that it does also encourage and inspire people to know that there's really good stuff happening. There's awesome people out there who are fronting lots of these projects, and also there's stuff that we can do at home if we want to. So I think just for me, That's something to remember. It's my takeaway.
Yep, I completely agree. Ocean optimism is a really important thing for us all to have. So thank you so much for listening to the Seagazing podcast, and thank you so much to Catherine for taking the time to join us today.
And if you want to find out more about MCS, there are links on our website at seagazing.com.
We also do really want to know what you think, so please do send us feedback or send us ideas for news stories. You can get us either at Nicolette@seagazing.com or Graham@seagazing.com.
You can also find us on Twitter at @seagazingpod. And remember, if you hit that subscribe button, it helps other people find us and also lets you know when we've got new episodes coming out. And if you give us a rate, ideally 5 stars, it will help other people find us.
Although, if the rating system is out of 10 stars, 10 would be great too.
Yeah, good point.
So, thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.